Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 2015 will mark the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. I'm sure there will be many books coming out next year. One that has just been released, probably in time for holiday giving, is a book with so many photos and a beautifully drawn narrative of Abraham Lincoln, titled simply Lincoln, An Intimate Portrait. Professor Alan Gelzo is the author of the narrative part of this book. He's a professor of the Civil War era and director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College. He's the author of so many books: Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, and Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Define America. Also, Lincoln, A Man of Ideas, and Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. He joins us this hour. The book actually covers all of Abraham Lincoln's life, and there are some extraordinary pictures. We were looking yesterday in the office at pictures of Abraham Lincoln from 1858 to 1863, and it's often said how much somebody ages when they're in office. The pictures, when you look at Abraham Lincoln from those years and how much he aged, is absolutely extraordinary. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Gelzo. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can always find us on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Alan Gelzo, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you and be able to speak to so many friends that we have in Wisconsin. I think especially all the Lincolnites there in the Milwaukee area who are very loyal to the memory of Abraham Lincoln and the Wisconsin Civil War Museum. There's such a wonderful pool of interest in Lincoln in the state of Wisconsin, and maybe that's appropriate given the fact that he spoke in Wisconsin, delivered some very important speeches there, especially in 1859 when he spoke at the Wisconsin State Agricultural Fair.
Well, thank you very much. You've put our place in history, and that was darn nice of you. Thank you. Illinois is not very far away. Well, you live in a place where I'd like to live for some period of time, and that's Gettysburg. And to do the kind of work that you're doing, what a labor of love, and what a wonderful thing to have done with your life to study this fascinating man.
Kathleen, I think I may be one of the most fortunate academics in the country, if not the world, because being a Civil War and Lincoln person in Gettysburg and at Gettysburg College is really like being a cat in catnip. It's the epicenter of Civil War interest. Mm-hmm. And when people ask me, well, you know, is your office in the college, close to the battlefield, I get to give a real smug, self-satisfied answer. It's on the battlefield.
That is quite an answer. That's where I work. You, there's so many incredible photos in this book, and you draw our attention to Abe when he was 37 years old, and you remind us it's only 7 years after photography had been introduced into America, and we've got this young-looking, maybe he's going to Wall Street kind of guy. Obviously, he wasn't in those years, but what we need to look at in the picture of Abe, who's dressed pretty nicely, are his hands, which say a whole lot about where he's been.
The hands in that daguerreotype are really the giveaway, because as you look at this very early, it's the earliest authentic photograph, the earliest, shall we say, certified photograph.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other competitors that have floated out there from time to time purporting to be an image of the young Lincoln, and really, for all that we know, they might have been. This one, though, has the best provenance because it was in the possession of Robert Todd Lincoln, and he identified it as the earliest photograph his possession of his father. And, you know, it really does not look like the Lincoln we're accustomed to seeing on the $5 bill.
No. And you have this quote. I'm not familiar with this quote from Lincoln, and it's one that makes you pause, actually. I have seen, he said, and you can tell from the picture when you look at his hands, I have seen a good deal of the backside of this world.
Right. Well, those hands, he said, got put to use when he was old enough to hold an axe. And he said from that point on until his 21st birthday, he was putting that axe to good use all the time. Because, Kathleen, he was not born to the FFVs by any stretch of the imagination. He is born on what is then the American frontier.
Mm-hmm.
And he is born into a family which, not to put too fine a point on it, is not what you would call economically, politically, socially, or culturally ambitious.
Right.
His father is a typical Jeffersonian, Jacksonian kind of farmer, and for him it was go day, come day, God send Sunday. The boy Abraham grows up in that environment, and as he said, his father taught him to work, but he never taught him to love work.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of work he was talking about was the hard, backbreaking work of frontier agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And he really did not fit in with that. There was something different about this boy and his gifts that was visible almost from the first. And his father resented it. His father thought the boy was just lazy and was wasting all his time on this thing that old Thomas Lincoln called education. But his stepmother, Sarah Bush Johnston Lincoln, saw something in a different way in her stepson, Abraham, and kind of in an inversion of the Hansel and Gretel evil stepmother story, she turns out to be the real angel in his life. She encourages him in the reading, even though for the most part she's practically illiterate herself.
Yeah, it's
but
really...
she encourages the boy that way. She shields him somewhat from the contempt of his father and gives him the freedom to see that reading, writing, learning, an ambition for something above this backside of the world was something worth entertaining.
And tell me more about his father hiring him out to work other farms and then keeping the money that his son made.
Oh, that grated on him. This was a fairly common practice because on what was then the Western frontier, one thing which was in terribly short supply was cash. So one way of obtaining cash was to sell goods to the market. Well, that was difficult for Thomas Lincoln because their farm was not exactly located near markets. Or to hire out the younger members of the family and to obtain cash that way. So that was what Thomas Lincoln did. And everything that young Abraham was hired out to do, not that he liked doing it in the first place, was afterwards funneled right back into Thomas Lincoln's hands. And Lincoln himself, Abraham Lincoln himself, would later describe that as being a kind of slavery.
Right.
Years afterwards, he said, I used to be a slave.
Hmm.
What he meant by that was he had been in thrall to his father. His father took away the proceeds of what he had earned. And that meant that for Lincoln, he starts out, very hostile to this idea of slavery. But second of all, he interprets slavery in a peculiarly economic fashion. For Lincoln, the fundamental injustice of slavery was really an economic one.
Mm-hmm. And did his father beat him very often?
Yes.
He did.
We don't know how often. They didn't keep records. But we do know from the testimony given by younger people who knew Lincoln when the Lincoln family lived in Indiana that, yes, Thomas Lincoln would, in fact, physically abuse his son.
You also write about this very important incident in his life. And why don't you describe this to us? When he was able to get his first money by constructing this little flatboat?
Talk about ambition. This is the sort of thing you expect to see from people who, at age 10, are setting up lemonade stands out of the curb
right.
And then go on to become Wall Street bankers.
this
is sort of the same thing. What Lincoln does is he puts together this little raft at the northern shoreline of the Ohio River, and he uses this as a kind of cab to paddle travelers out to midstream where they can flag down oncoming steamboats. Steamboats plied the Ohio River heavily, but there were few and far between landings and stops. So it was actually very common for porters and for ambitious types to set up their own little boat service to ferry people out to the steamboats that would stop and take them on board. Well, Lincoln decides that he can do that, so he cobbles together this boat. Two characters come down in a big hurry, hats and suits flying, jump on his raft and tell him to paddle him out to an oncoming steamer, which he does. And in their hurry to scramble on board the steamboat, they toss back to him, each of them, a silver half dollar. And he catches this up and he looks at it. He says, "My goodness, real money. And it's mine." That, he said, that, as he explained this years later to his Secretary of State, he said, "That may sound like a very small thing to you, but to me, that was a really dramatic moment. Suddenly, Abraham Lincoln had entered the market economy."
He could make money that was his own. And is there a lot of writing, Professor, about his relationship with his father? I'm interested that he didn't go to his funeral. I guess Lincoln was living in Springfield when his father died. He didn't go to his funeral. He must have just dismissed him from his life for his cruelty or his lack of interest in his son's life or putting him out on his own when he was 12 years old. Did he ever explain why? Did he talk a lot about his father or not?
No, there were some moments that he had a few things to say about his father. In one campaign autobiography that he wrote in 1859, 1860, he spoke about his father being a man who was bunglingly able to sign his own name. He was trying to give an idea that Thomas was, okay, marginally literate. But it doesn't really sound very much like a compliment, though, does it?
No, it doesn't.
There's no testimony from any person who left any testimony behind of Thomas Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln ever showing any kind of affection, ever talking about each other in affectionate father-son terms. And when Thomas Lincoln lay in his last illness, he appealed to his stepson, John Johnston, to write to Lincoln and have him come down to the deathbed because old Thomas Lincoln wanted to see his natural son one more time. And amazingly, Lincoln writes back to John Johnston. Even though Johnston said, "The old man is calling for you," he writes back to Johnston and says, "You know, I really don't think, after all that's gone on between us, it would really make matters much better. You know, tell the old man to trust in God and all will be well." And that's it. And he does not come down to the cabin in Coles County where his father died. He does not go to the funeral. He does not, in fact, pay out to have a headstone put in his father's grave. There is a well of chilliness in the relationship between these two that from the outside is very difficult to fathom. But on the other hand, how often have we seen it be the case that very ordinary fathers with very extraordinary sons really find themselves looking at each other like they are two strangers on the midnight run to Albany?
Interesting. And yet they say that we frequently parent as we've been parented. When you look at the way Abraham Lincoln parented his sons, he seemed to be quite the opposite of his father, perhaps even indulgent, funny, telling stories, playing with them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's almost as though he was compensating in the other direction.
Right.
There's no example of Abraham Lincoln ever administering corporal punishment to any of his children. And, in fact, when a few people suggested that some of his boys deserved it, his response was, "Well, the way you bind children to you is by love." He would let them get away anything.
Right.
The kids were the despair of Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon. Herndon wrote about how the boys would come down to the law office with Lincoln, and they'd just tear the place apart. They'd break the pencils, they'd spill ink, and Herndon, of course, would have even happy, he said, to have wrung their little necks. But as far as Lincoln was concerned, you know, Lincoln thought it was all funny. In fact, Herndon said, Lincoln would have thought it was funny if they had defecated in his top hat.
Oh.
He would somehow have made a joke out of that. So, I mean, Lincoln's approach to his sons was the diametric opposite of the kind of parenting experience he had received at the hands of his father.
We welcome phone calls for our guests. We're doing a Lincoln Show today because we wanted you to take note of this really beautiful book that has just been released, 2015, as we've said, the 150th anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This book looks at the course of his whole life, and it is filled with beautiful, well, he was an incredible writer, one of the best of the century, some have said, of his writing, his speeches, pictures, many, many pictures of Abraham Lincoln and his family and important pictures from the Civil War. They're all in Lincoln, An Intimate Portrait. It's just been published by Life, and our guest has written quite beautifully about the whole, just no small feat to write about the whole course of Lincoln's life. He's written the narrative for this book. Professor Alan Gelzo is a professor of the Civil War era, director of Civil War studies at Gettysburg College. So his offices are on the battlefield, actually. He's written many books about Abraham Lincoln and won many awards for those. Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America, Abraham Lincoln, A Man of Ideas, and Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. We will get to we never spent a whole lot of time talking about his early life, so I wanted to cover that during part of this show. We will move into his time in Illinois and why it is, as our guest writes, the Whigs captured his loyalty, who the Whigs were and why they captured his loyalty, and of course move into Mary Todd Lincoln and the Civil War, etc. But join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we love to read your messages, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For you to join our conversation as we talk about Lincoln, An Intimate Portrait, with the professor who has written the narrative that accompanies this book that is filled with photos and beautifully written narrative, Professor Alan Gelzo, as a Lincoln historian and a professor of the Civil War era, director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's start our calls with Phil in Madison. Hi, Phil. Hi, Phil.
I want you to have it off because I get feedback.
Yeah, you'll need to have it off. Phil, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Thanks. It's a great show. Yeah, we had a diary that turned up in our family 14 years ago when my uncle passed away. It was written by a young woman in Delavan in the 3 years prior to the Civil War. Anyway, she preserved a letter that she got from one of her girlhood friends in upstate New York where the family had come from. And the letters, they had gone to see Lincoln.
Oh.
And apparently, like, Lincoln passed through Syracuse on his way to Washington after he was elected. But she says, "Dear Mary, I trust you are a Republican and wanted to tell you about seeing our wonderful president, Abraham Lincoln, the honest and true." And my question for the professor is, how much that image of him as an honest person showed him in political life?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Well, the sobriquet Honest Abe was attached to the man very early on and persisted through his entire political career. He was able to project an image of simplicity and transparency that induced trust in large degrees. He was not the sort of person who tried to overwhelm and impress people by his demagogic powers. Rather, he preferred, even in front of large audiences, to reason with them, to lay out propositions, to say, on the one hand, on the other, so that when people heard Lincoln speaking, they didn't feel like they were being given a snow job by a politician so much as they were being invited to a discussion, a conversation, with a remarkably intelligent person who at the very first they might not have thought was such. I don't know about that correspondent in Syracuse, and my guess is that when that person first saw Lincoln on the train, they might have been a little bit taken aback, as many people were, because he was, not to try to cushion this too much, he was homely looking. And many people said, well, how can a man like this, who looks like a janitor or maybe a rough, intelligent farmer, how can this man be the president of the United States? The curiosity is that people who said that or thought that or who jumped to the conclusion that this man really could not have been a terribly impressive person were underestimating a man that it was dangerous to underestimate. One of his longtime legal associates on the 8th Judicial Circuit in Illinois said that anyone who took Abraham Lincoln for a simple-minded man would soon wake up with his back in a ditch. That honesty was part of what convinced people, oh, well, here is a man who, precisely because he's honest, probably doesn't have much substance. Well, that turned out to be very untrue, and there were a lot of sorrowful politicians afterwards who realized that the man's simple honesty and simple transparency were not, in fact, all that simple at all.
I don't know if you have the book in front of you, but I got to say, on page 151 in the book, there's a picture of Abraham Lincoln, and he's a pretty good-looking guy.
Well, he did enjoy getting his picture taken, and the book itself is something of a testimony to that, Catherine.
Yes, there are so many.
Well, you've got this beautiful, oversized book, and there are approximately 130 photographs of Lincoln reproduced in that book, from various archives, private holdings, public holdings, the Library of Congress. So here is a face which got to be very well photographed during the 19th century when photography is still very much in its infancy. So he did like it. At the same time, though, he's also very aware of the fact that he's not the most handsome, the most theatrical looking. And he made jokes about that himself.
Mm-hmm.
On one occasion, a photographer was telling him what photographers tell us all, and that is, just look natural. And Lincoln's response was, that's what I'm trying to avoid. And yet for all of that self-awareness, and notice, by the way, he makes the joke first. He'll make the joke so he can do it on his own terms.
Right.
He knows if he doesn't, someone else is going to.
Right, exactly. And also, there's something endearing about self-deprecation, too.
That's right, yeah. Well, nevertheless, he really does like getting his picture taken, and he appears very often before the photographers. He goes down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Executive Mansion to the studios of Matthew Brady on Pennsylvania Avenue, and then Alexander Gardner just off Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, he'll go repeatedly to have his photograph taken. So there was a streak of, shall we say, vanity within Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And John Hay once said, let's not think of Lincoln as a humble man. No great man ever really was truly humble. And I think there's a certain sense of that in Lincoln. There was humility in the man, humility in the sense that he knew there was a line beyond which he should not go in taking himself too seriously. Yet at the same time, there was a lot of self-confidence in the man that he knew the direction that he was taking was right, and the people who tried to nudge him away from that were wrong. John Hay once made the comment to him, well, certainly all these newspaper editors are advising you to do X, Y, and Z. And Lincoln's response was, I pay no attention to them because I know more about the subject than they do.
Oh, That's quite a response. Tell me where you think, I've said this before, that whenever I read him, and I've read an awful lot about Lincoln, I love to read his speeches, and I like to read them aloud. So many have said that he was just a brilliant writer, and it just astounds me. Anybody who's a Lincoln scholar, I ask the same question. Where did he learn to be such a beautiful, beautiful writer when he just didn't go to school?
Well, the odd thing is that Lincoln was not, in his own day, regarded as a beautiful writer.
Mm.
The standards for literary greatness, literary excellence in Lincoln's day, were the standards that were set by classical speech, by classical learning. And so the really elegant literature of the day are these enormous three-decker novels, long, drawn-out political speeches that are heavy with dependent clauses, so many of them that they almost seem like apples that are going to fall off the tree, plus classical allusions to this, that, and the other. And a really good example of what was considered to be truly elegant was the oration given at Gettysburg on November 19th, 1863, by Edward Everett.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we remember that event because that's where Lincoln delivers the Gettysburg Address. But the primary orator for that event was Edward Everett, and his speech was full of Athens, Cyrus, the Romans, Thermopylae.
Goodness.
It would go on, and it did go on and on. Like I forgot.
Right. Right. Was it any good? Was it well written?
By the standards of its day, it was perfect. By contrast, when Lincoln spoke or wrote public documents, people talked about his queer and unusual way of putting himself. And the reason that people heard it that way was that what Lincoln had adopted was not the pattern of classical speech. What he had adopted was the pattern of what we can call middling speech. Middling speech was the speech of the newspapers, of the popular preachers, and even to a certain extent of the lawyers. These were people who were not speaking to be admired for their speaking. These people who were speaking for a living. They were speaking to communicate. And Lincoln, as a trial lawyer, which he was for 24 years of his life, Lincoln has his own style shaped by the experience of having to persuade juries. And in many cases, juries that are drawn together simply from people who happen to be bystanders in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
He has had to learn how to communicate directly without shilly-shallying around, or he wouldn't have been in the practice of law for very long.
Hmm.
It's that makes Lincoln unique as a speaker. He didn't dress up in the accepted forms. Rather, he spoke directly as a middling speaker, aiming to persuade. Now, the curious thing is that he is so good at that, that in real truth, Abraham Lincoln, together with his counterpart, Mark Twain, who was the other great promoter of this middling speech, Lincoln and Twain really accomplished something of a revolution in American speech, in American letters. And the distance that there was between Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and Edward Everett's oration really is, I think, the distance between the death of the old classical speech and the emergence of an entirely new kind of literary speech. That you might say that with the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln killed the old classical speech, because Edward Everett's oration was a beautiful example of the old speech, but also a beautiful example of all of its limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what Lincoln had to say in his middling speech just soared far way beyond that.
Yes. Oh, it does.
Becomes a dominant genre. So what Lincoln does with this speech of his is he makes it beautiful in our ears. And it remains beautiful in our ears because Lincoln helps to create this revolution in our expectations of what literary style is supposed to be.
Phil, thank you very much for your call. Our phone number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And we go next to Kathy in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
enjoying this so much. What I need is a little, actually, advice for a Christmas gift. I have a 13-year-old granddaughter who is just right now on fire with history. She loves it, and I want to foster that. And I wondered if the book currently being discussed would be a good one for her, or if you could recommend something else or other books that might help me with that.
I would say yes, Kathy.
Well, I blush to admit, but I would say yes. I say that because,
like it
you know, I was in a situation not unlike the young lady whom you're describing, age
really?
13, interested in history. And what I got hold of, and it was actually my first real Lincoln book, it was Stephen Lawrence's old picture story of the life of Abraham Lincoln.
Mm.
And it was one of these early collections of Lincoln photographs. It entranced me.
Hmm.
And you might say that I became a Lincolnite from the moment that book came into my hands.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
And that, so a picture book, a big one, a serious one, not just like a children's book, but one which, for someone who is 13, can speak clearly and yet give all these wonderful views from the 19th century of Abraham Lincoln. I think she might come down with the Lincoln bug as a permanent acquisition. And when she does that, would you please then get her signed up to come to Gettysburg College?
So I'll do my very best.
Oh, Kathy, her whole life is before her, and we've got it
That's planned, right?
We've got it planned. It sounds great.
Yeah, I think she'd love the book.
I will be looking for it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Where did you grow up, Professor?
Well, actually, I was born in, believe it or not, Japan.
Really?
Yes. My father was United States Army. He was stationed in Japan. He was an officer in transportation and a translator at the peace talks at Panmunjom in the Korean War.
Hmm.
So my mother went over to Japan with him, and I made my debut.
Hmm.
Mostly, though, I've grown up in the Pennsylvania area and went to all the schools I've gone to have been in the larger Philadelphia area. So I consider myself, for all practical purposes, a Pennsylvanian, a Philadelphia boy, and I'm only too happy to point out to people the occasions when Lincoln visited Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I grew up in Illinois, and just, you know, the eighth grade field trip to New Salem and to Springfield. I've been back so many times. I love being from Illinois, where Lincoln, you know, spent so much time. It made a huge impression on me at a very, when I was, you know, again, about the age of her granddaughter, visiting all of that in Springfield. And he's been close to my heart ever since, Abraham Lincoln.
Well, I have enjoyed hugely all of the occasions, and there are many, that I have been able to be in Illinois, and especially in Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
Because Springfield just teems with associations of Abraham Lincoln.
It sure does.
Abraham Lincoln home is there.
Yes.
The old state capitol building is there. And there are such wonderful people in Springfield for whom their devotion to Lincoln is such that you almost feel like Lincoln only left Springfield a few weeks ago.
I know, it's true. We were eating at some of those places where all kinds of people eat, and all of a sudden this guy who's dressed as Abraham Lincoln, who's an Abraham Lincoln impersonator, shows up, and I thought, oh, this is too much. This is great here. And he was great. He was terrific. Oh, it was fun.
There is actually an organization of Lincoln presenters who do Lincoln reenacting. There are about 220 of them. They have an annual conference, and I tell you, the annual conference, imagine walking into the hotel where walking into the lobby where there are 200 people in black suits and tall stovepipe hats. And at that point, you start wondering, now what was it I was drinking last night?
Yeah, I'll bet. Actually,
you know, they're great people. They are really dedicated to the memory of Lincoln and to getting out the message of Lincoln. And they're just absolutely fun folks to work with.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that I was talking to some Lincoln scholar a few weeks ago who said that he was at Gettysburg for the annual reenactment of the address, and that this year's Lincoln impersonator who reads the address for all of the gathered scholars was very good.
Oh, yes. That's Jim Geddes, our own home town
and
presenter. Jim has been doing this for, oh my goodness, 30-odd years. And it's curious because from time to time, being in Gettysburg, I'll run into Jim in the giant food market. Now, just think what this is like when you're in the vegetable section, and the person over you from you is Abraham Lincoln. I remember one time he turned the corner. He was driving his pickup truck in a red flannel shirt, and he turns the corner just near my house. And I'm passing, and I'm thinking, how is it like? What does it do to you when Abraham Lincoln in a red flannel shirt and a pickup truck turns the corner? I mean, because Gettysburg is really one of those places where people can walk around in 19th century dress. Nobody bats an eye.
Right. I'm sure that's true. It's such a profound place as well. Let's go to more calls. Don in Lafarge. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Here.
I just wanted to mention, I heard or read someplace that at Gettysburg, after both Edward Everett and Lincoln were done speaking, Everett complimented Lincoln. He said something along the lines of, you said in 3 minutes what I didn't get at in 3 hours. So
yes.
Everett knew that it was a really great speech, and, you know, he just wasn't able to make it like that, but he saw that what it was and complimented Lincoln.
The Gettysburg Address really is a marvel of compression. Everett's oration was 13,500 words long. It was a survey of the entire Civil War. It was a mini-history. Lincoln's speech is 272 words. Now, bear in mind, they were serving two different purposes. Everett was supposed to deliver a huge oration because he was literally the featured speaker. All that Lincoln had been invited to do was to deliver the dedication, the actual dedication remarks of the Soldiers' National Cemetery. So he understood he was expected to be short. But even so, 272 words was short even for the 19th century. And yet, within those 272 words, he manages to give us the past, right in the first sentence, the present, we're gathered here in this battlefield,
mm-hmm.
and the future, what mm-hmm. we should be doing, which is to dedicate ourselves to the same purpose that the soldiers had dedicated themselves. It is a marvel of, a sublime marvel of compression, of being able to, of clarity, and of being able to take huge ideas and being able to express them as simply as they could possibly be expressed.
Yes, it is. Our guest this hour is Professor Alan Gelzo. He's he wrote the narrative for this beautiful book about Abraham Lincoln that Life magazine has published. It's very large. It's Lincoln, an intimate portrait, and it includes 135 or so portraits, pictures of Lincoln, some of which have never been published before, and a narrative that covers the whole course of Lincoln's life. And that narrative is written by our guest this hour, who's a professor of the Civil War era, director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College, author of Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America, and Abraham Lincoln, A Man of Ideas, and another one, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marty called. She mentioned there's a new movie out now that depicts Lincoln's childhood. It's called The Better Angels. She's wondering if you have seen the movie and would you recommend it?
Seen the movie. I have heard of it, but I haven't yet had an opportunity to track down a place where it's being shown. But I will have to keep my eye out for it because I try to at least take in whatever Lincoln movies there are out there. Sometimes they're a little strange. The most recent strange one being Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Yeah, I wouldn't see that. Mm-mm.
Well, I did see it, but
did
it
you?
Was more or less out of a sense of duty. And,
right.
And it had a certain campy humor about it.
Hmm.
The most important of the recent crop of Lincoln films and depictions, though, is the Spielberg Lincoln movie.
Oh, I love that movie. I really did.
Which I was deeply impressed by.
Yes.
I thought that it got everything about 90% perfectly on the mark, which is saying a great deal for mm-hmm. Hollywood production. And I think that, above all, it did something very difficult for a movie to do, and that is to make the democratic process, amendment, to make that process look something like something wonderful and attractive.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that movie. And what an extraordinary performance from Daniel Day-Lewis. It was good. Dominique in Cudahy. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
My question for the guest is, it seems like it's pretty obvious that Lincoln is a national icon and a hero to a lot of people. So many so that there's a lot of people who impersonate him. My question is, there's so many people that impersonate Lincoln, why isn't anybody emulating Lincoln?
Because to dress up and look like Lincoln is easier than to actually be the man himself. And part of that is because in many ways it is difficult to plumb the inner life of the man. He was a very private man. He did not, in an age of great diary keepers, keep a diary. In an age of great letter writers, most of his correspondence is strictly business. He does not reveal himself easily to people. William Herndon, who knew him for all the years of their shared law practice, some 14 years, even William Herndon said that Abraham Lincoln was a man who kept half of himself back from people and then kept half of that even from his closest friends, so that anybody who claimed to have really known Lincoln, usually Herndon said, you could pretty well discount anything they would say after that, because nobody really understood the man. Other friends of his echoed that estimate. Judge David Davis, who presided over the 8th Judicial Circuit while Lincoln was a practicing attorney on that circuit, said that as close as he was to Lincoln, and Lincoln, in fact, appoints him to the United States Supreme Court in 1862, despite that, Davis said that Lincoln was a mystery to him. He'd never been able to plumb the depths of Lincoln's character. And many other people had this same sense, as Carl Sandburg once put it, of Lincoln being the strange friend and the friendly stranger.
Hmm.
Somehow what you met when you met Lincoln was always the surface of a shield. And you were always asking yourself, is it really him that I'm hearing? Is it really him that I'm talking to?
Well, what about you? You've spent a lifetime as a scholar looking at who he is, his character. Do you feel the same way?
Yes.
You do?
There's so much about him I cannot even begin to understand.
Hmm.
There are things I can take educated guesses at, but I can't really do more than that. And in truth, neither could many of his friends. After Lincoln's death, Leonard Swett, with whom he practiced law for many years in Illinois, wrote to William Herndon on the assumption that Herndon would know the answer. And the question he posed was this: what was the skeleton in Lincoln's closet? What was it that he never told us about himself? Write it down on a piece of paper, send it to me by Adams Express, and I will send it right back to you.
And? Oh, no. So they have door phone line. Well, we'll have to get the rest of that story.
But even his close friends.
I'm sorry, we missed the rest of that story.
And I have to admit, there's a great deal about Lincoln that not only do I not know, but that continues to surprise me.
Oh, but you know what happened? For about 30 seconds, something happened. You evaporated. We didn't hear you. So what happened after he sent that? We didn't hear the rest of the story.
Oh, Herndon was unable to send anything to him because Herndon didn't know what this skeleton was supposed to be.
Nobody knew it.
Nobody knew it.
Wow. Wow.
Or even if it was an it or many its or whatever.
Yeah.
Lincoln would have been a very difficult person to play poker with.
Dominique, thanks for your call. Richard in Stevens Point, hi.
Hello. Today, December 18th, is the anniversary of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery in 1865.
That is true.
Anniversary of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery.
Yes. Did you want to add anything to that, Richard? Would you like to talk about that process? Holy Toledo, what a time in American history. It will be perpetually hard for me to understand what it was like to be alive and the divisions in this country over something that seems so self-evident, so moral, so right, and yet people were willing to die for
slavery. Well, understand that before the Civil War, slavery was a very profitable institution. Some mm-hmm. people believe that slavery was backwards and was gradually dying out, and why didn't we just let the sleeping dog lie? That's not true. The single most important export commodity of the United States before the Civil War was cotton. That amounted to 75% of all American commodity exports. That cotton was grown by slaves. So slaves were generating a tremendous amount of profit for their owners. And their owners weren't going to give that up or see it threatened with any kind of impunity. That interest, Lincoln said, was what brought things to the brink of civil war. It was to defend that interest, to sacrifice the Union to that interest, that the war came. Lincoln, on the other hand, had always hated slavery. As he said, I can't ever remember a time when I didn't hate slavery. The big question for Lincoln was, what could he do about it? Because slavery was legalized in the states. It was not a federal matter. And he had no authority as President of the United States to reach over the federal-state boundary and start dealing with slavery in the states. He tries to do that through military means, and that's what gives us the Emancipation Proclamation. But he realizes that even that is a very limited way of dealing with slavery. The only way you're going to expunge slavery completely from the country is by a constitutional amendment. That, he said, is the king's cure for the evil. And it's that process that he embarks upon in 1864. And he waits until 1864 to do that because there really would not have been sufficient political capital in Congress to have sustained it before that.
Yeah. We only have about a minute left. Tell me about the process of, first tell me the pictures. I read that there are some photos here that have never been published before. Do you know what those are, Professor Gelza?
These are mostly photographs of Lincoln in groups. Lincoln on the deck of a ship, Lincoln with a number of individuals out in front of the White House. Some of these actually have been known for some time, but there have been questions about exactly whether these are Lincoln or not. But they're included in the book because there seems to be a more than reasonably high presumption that, after all, these are legitimate images of Abraham Lincoln.
I see.
What I expect, though, is that this will not be the last word on Lincoln photographs. There are always attics and there are always trunks. And out of them come images of Lincoln we have not seen before. So I fully expect that in the years to come, we'll have to do yet another book of Lincoln photographs that will include ones that have subsequently been discovered. That gives us, I think, a reason to be enthusiastic and out on the eye for Lincoln images. We haven't yet gotten Lincoln out of our sight.
Right. Thank you so much. And your narrative is beautifully written that accompanies the book. Congratulations to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Professor Alan Gelzo. He is the writer of the narrative that appears alongside a number of photographs of Abraham Lincoln and family. An intimate portrait, life, just been published, and It's quite a collector's piece. He is Professor Gelzo, Professor of the Civil War Era, Director of Civil War Era Studies at Gettysburg College, and is author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, and a number of other books. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in Milwaukee. I'll be gone for Christmas week, so I hope you have wonderful holidays, Hanukkah, Christmas, and I'll be with you the last couple days of 2014. How did that happen? 2014 almost over. Thank you for listening.